Good morning. Glad to be here. My family. So my name's Ryan. I have my wife Erin here. My son Jonah and Kira, and then Lucy and Mitchell are heading out. We're from Kitchener, so it's a bit of a jaunt coming up this way. But I'm not unfamiliar with the North. I have cousins that grew up in Naunton, so it used to come up this way quite often and come for business and all that sort of stuff. I got together with them last night, and so it was quite nice to be up here. We're going to be looking in Daniel chapter 6, if you want to turn in your Bibles to that. And what I want to talk about is living a life of integrity, and we see an example of that in the life of Daniel. But as we look around us, we see kind of failures of integrity quite often in our leaders and people of import. You see it in world leaders. Kind of the biggest story, if any of you are on any kind of social media or whatever, the biggest story of the last week has been a failure of integrity in an astronomer CEO and things going on there, a lack of integrity in his personal life with one of his employees. And so it's, you know, like that specific instance is shocking, and how it happened in such a public place at a Coldplay concert and whatever is kind of interesting and unusual. But the fact that that happened, I don't think is really shocking to a whole lot of people, that there was something, you know, something going on with powerful and important people. And so a lack of integrity is something we see in very important people. We're going to talk about living a life of integrity, and kind of what that sounds like or looks like is having strong moral principles is kind of the idea. If you have integrity, it means that you have strong moral principles. Now, failing to do that means that you don't have integrity. And so at work, I work for the city of Kitchener. I'm an accountant by trade, and we talk about integrity being doing what you should, even if people aren't watching. And so, you know, examples of that, you know, kind of a work setting is, you know, like, are you putting in your full day's work? Are you doing what you should be spending your time on? You might have that, you know, kind of in your personal life as well. You know, like, would you be watching that if, you know, your parent was in the room with you, or your spouse, or what have you? Would you, you know, be sneaking that food in the late hours of the evening if other people were around? Those kinds of things. And so having integrity of character is something that's pretty important. We're going to see in the life of Daniel that he is somebody that demonstrated a life of integrity, not only when people were not watching, but when they were, which in his example was pretty tough. And so if you've, you know, have any exposure to the Bible, you're probably familiar to the story of Daniel in the lion's den. It's kind of a classic Sunday school story that I'm sure you're familiar with. But we're going to read through the whole chapter. We're going to do it in sections and just kind of talk about what that means. And so we're going to start at the very beginning of the chapter and read through the first 9 verses. And this is sort of the setup to the whole situation. And so it reads like this, Daniel 6, verse 1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom and over these 3 governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could not find, or they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said to him, thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors, the advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or a man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish this decree and sign it into writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree." So we'll just talk about that briefly. We see that Darius, he's the Mede, so that's kind of the country that he's from. Again, if you're unfamiliar with the history of things, there was the nation of Israel. They got taken over by the Babylonians. There were a couple of kings there. So there was Nebuchadnezzar, there was Belshazzar, and then the Medes come in and take over. And so Darius is kind of the third king that has taken over the Jewish nation. And so he's the king over everything, and he's setting up his government, just like anybody kind of would. It's big, it takes a lot of space. Again, I work in local government, so I'm familiar with it. We have our structure there, just like in most businesses or whatever. You kind of have the main person at the top, and then there's a few more people that have responsibilities over a few things, and there's more people that have responsibilities over a few things, over more things. And the lower you go, the more detailed it is, and kind of a pyramid out. Not a pyramid scheme, but just pyramids out. It's kind of a natural way to organize a business, or a structure, or a government in this case. So Darius is in charge, and he says he's setting up his kingdom. And it says the structure for it is he kind of has three governors, and there's 120 satraps who are in charge of things. And so he has these different layers of responsibility, and we read about Daniel that he's one of the three. And so he's one of the kind of more elevated people in the governmental structure, and so he's one of the king's kind of closest advisors. And not only that, we read in here that Darius was even thinking about making Daniel kind of his right-hand person. That out of those three, he sort of excelled, and that he was going to be potentially the number one person just below the king. And so because of that, it's evident that Daniel must have been a good worker. You would not kind of make your right-hand person somebody who's always showing up late or like slacking off on time, not really doing anything. It appears that he must have been a good worker and that he did it with a good attitude. And so that's a great testimony of David or of Daniel. But we read about his compatriots that they're jealous of him. And they sought a way to bring him down. They were kind of upset that he had been elevated to that rank, that it seems like they probably understood that he was kind of favored by the king. And so they were looking for a way to bring him down. Now, out of the three governors, for the other two, that might have meant that they became the king's favorite. So there was something in it for them. They were looking for a way to drag Daniel down so that they could be elevated. And then, again, the other satraps, maybe, there's 120 of them, there's three above them, so maybe it needs an elevation for one of them. They saw it as a bit of a zero-sum game. The only way I can move up is if somebody moves down or is taken out of the picture. And so they're looking for a way to get rid of Daniel because they want to be in his position. But we read that they ran into a problem in verse 4. They couldn't find anything to accuse Daniel of. They were looking for a way to drag this guy down, but they said they couldn't find anything wrong with him. And what we read about it in verse 4 is that he was faithful, and again, that kind of shows that he had professional integrity in what he was doing. Maybe they were looking for, is Daniel skimming a little bit off the top, or is he keeping things to himself, or are there things that are kind of hidden that shouldn't be? Maybe they were looking at the things that they did, right? They're like, oh, here's my scheme. I do this, and I sock away some money over here for myself. But they were trying to find something wrong with him. But we read that he was faithful to the king, who, again, is not his king. It wasn't like it was one of his friends. It was somebody that had come and conquered his nation. And so Daniel would have had an easy time to be like, it's not my king. I don't like this guy. I work, again, in a local government. We get different counselors, different mayors in with different agendas and all that sort of stuff. It'd be easy in my setting to be like, oh, I don't like this mayor. I don't really have to try very hard. But I'm not there to, serve the mayor in that capacity and, follow the agenda. I'm there to do my job with integrity, to the best of my ability, regardless of what the agendas of the elected officials are. And so Daniel kind of had that similar attitude that regardless of who was in charge, he was going to do the best job he could. He's not going to steal money just because he doesn't like the king. He's going to live his life with professional integrity. And so he was faithful, and they couldn't find anything wrong with him. or that he was faithful to him. We also read that there was no error or fault found in him at the end of verse 4. So he had personal integrity. He wasn't, again, just, you know, doing whatever he wanted because, you know, derelict personal character. So he had professional integrity, he had personal integrity. And then when they looked into him and they couldn't find anything wrong with him, they say, you know what? I think the only way we can get this guy is because of his God. Because he had, you know, a different belief system than the rest of them. And so they figured that the only way that they might be able to bring him down was because he was too faithful to his God. And what a great testimony that is of Daniel. Right? Like, if the only thing that people could say about you, or bad about you, is like, they're too godly. Like, that would be a great testimony amongst other people. Instead of, yeah, that guy shows up late. Or, they're not really good at their job. It's like, no, they're too godly, they're too honest, you know, they're too helpful. Yeah, that would be a real bad problem to have, right? So that's what they find, though. They are looking for a way, they're trying to find it out, and they just say, the only thing we think we might be able to do is to bring him down because he's too devoted to his God. So then they devise this plot, as we see in verse 6 through 9. And this plot brought forward to get him thrown into the lion's den because of his faithfulness to God. But they do it kind of in a subversive way. They use falsehood and flattery. They go forward to the king, King Darius, and they say in verse 7, all the governors of the kingdoms, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors, and advisors, so like all of the kind of government has gotten together, and we agree that this is the one thing we want to do, and that one thing is that everybody should pray only to you for the next month. Now, earlier in the chapter, we read about the governors doing that, and the satraps, not all these other people, but at least one person is not there. Daniel's not there. When they're having this meeting and this concoction of, things, Daniel's not in the room. So they go forward and they lie to the king and say, you know what, we all got together and you know what, we all think this is a really good idea, that only you should be the only person that is prayed to. So that's flat out false. That's not true. Plus they throw in all these other people that aren't listed earlier in the chapter as being there. They use falsehood and then they use flattery as well. And they bring forward this idea that, you know, the king should be the exalted person in all of this, that everybody should pray to him. And so that puts the king in a bit of an awkward position. Like, who wouldn't want that, honestly? You know, like, we think that, or, you know, they come forward to him with this idea of, you know what, you're a really important person. We think everybody should bring all their problems kind of to you, but, like, you don't actually have to solve them. It's not like they're actually going to have an audience with you and come and talk to you personally, but everybody should pray, and it should be to you. So everybody's mind is going to be on you as, like, a really important person. And so they bring forward this idea with falsehood and flattery to the king. And so he ends up being seduced by it and being fooled by it. And he says, yeah, I think that is a good idea. And so he signs it into law. And so for the next 30 days, the only person that can be prayed to is the king. And it says toward the end of that section in verse 8 that it could not be changed because the laws of the Medes and Persians does not alter. And so that was going to be enforced for 30 days. That was something that was going to happen. So that's the setup of the whole situation. We're going to see verses 10 through 17, we're going to see the takedown that happens because of the setup. So starting in verse 10, it reads, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with the windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then his men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And the king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or from the decree which you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored until the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes of the Persians, that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed." So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king said to spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." Then a stone was brought and laid at the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring, and with the signets of his lords, that the purposes concerning Daniel might not be changed. And so Daniel is in this situation that's pretty sticky for him, right? This new law gets put in place, and it's basically saying that he can't do what he wants to do, that he is not allowed to pray to his God 3 times a day. But he hears it, and right at the very beginning of this, in verse 10, he says, "When he knew it was past, he went home, and he went to his upper room, like his habit was of old, and he got down. He opened up his window, and he prayed toward Jerusalem 3 times that day. And, he has such integrity with his devotion to the Lord that he's going to go through what was common to him, even though he knew that there was going to be or there could easily be a consequence. He didn't necessarily know if he was going to be caught, but he knew that it was probable, or even possible. So he goes up and he prays, and lo and behold, guess what happens? Looks like some of the people that came up with the law just happened to be walking by his place, and they see him praying to his God. Like, what a coincidence, right? Who would have thought that might happen? They designed a law specifically for one person, and then they go and they are like scouting him, watching him, and they catch him doing what they knew he was going to do because they understood the integrity that he had in his life. And that praying to his God was like eating. He was going to do it 3 times a day. It was going to happen. So they happened to just go by and conveniently find him doing what they knew he was going to do. So they run off and they find the king, and they say, "Somebody's broken this law. Like, didn't you sign this into force?" And the king says, yeah, I did. And then they say, "Oh, somebody broke it. And that person is Daniel." And if you look at it, as they talk about Daniel, in verse 13, they say, "That Daniel, who's one of the captives of Judah." They hadn't forgotten who Daniel was. It seems like part of the reason that they were upset with him was because of where he was from and all that sort of stuff. So it seems like at least part of the reason they didn't like him was because he was from a different religion and all that sort of stuff, that they were trying to drag him down. He was one of their peers, or superiors even. He was one of the governors. They knew that he was kind of the king's right-hand man. They don't just say, "Daniel, the governor," or "Daniel, your trusted advisor," or whatever. They kind of debase him to, that guy from Judah, and talk about him in that way, and drag him down as they're saying that he's the one breaking the law. He's praying to the God of Judah, not to you. And then the king has this, reaction that shows just how much he cared about Daniel. That when he heard the words, it says he was greatly displeased, not with Daniel, but with himself. He was like, "Oh, they got me." Right? He understood that he had created this law that really wasn't right, and that there was a consequence for somebody that was important to him because of it. And then he is trying to do all these mental gymnastics, trying to figure out a way, like, okay, I know the law can't change, but is there some way that maybe I can save Daniel from the consequence of being thrown into the lion's den? And it says that he labored all day long. But again, at the end of the day, the piper needs to be paid. And they come and they catch him, or they come to the king at the end of the day and say, "Hey, you got to go through with this. You can't pick and choose what gets enforced and what doesn't." So And so they throw him into the lion's den. But we see that the king is hopeful at the end of this section. He says in verse 16, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. So it sounds like the king is optimistic. You know, even Daniel, even though he's basically being sentenced to death, being thrown into a lion's den, that, you know, maybe your God is powerful and all of that sort of stuff, and maybe he'll be able to deliver you. And sure enough, the chapter closes with the stone being rolled in front and Daniel being sealed into the den. So that's the takedown. Daniel was set up to fail. They take him down, but we're going to see there's a twist ending to this story, which, again, I'm sure it won't be a surprise to most of the people here that are listening today. But starting in verse 18, to the end of the chapter, we read, now the king went to his palace and spent the night fast. No musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? But Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, so that they have not hurt me. Because I was found innocent before him, and also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Now the king was exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den. No injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And the king gave a command, and they brought those men whom accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Then their children and their wives and the lions overpowered them, and broke all their bones into pieces before they even came to the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and steadfast forever. His kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus, or Persian. So there's, again, this twist ending to the story. Daniel's, you know, detractors are like, got this guy, right? We totally wrote a law to catch this one guy. We caught this one guy. He's going to be thrown into the lion's den. Boom, problem solved. One of us, you know, it would have been interesting to see between the two other governors that were left over who thought they were going to be number one, and if there would have been like some other thing going on trying to take him down. I'm a Star Wars guy. I kind of think of it like the Sith, and it was like, okay, which first person's going to backstab the other person? If you don't like Star Wars, that won't make any sense to you, but those of you who know, know. Anyway, they are, they thought they got this guy, but then when the king wakes up in the morning, the king says he goes to sleep, and he sounded like he was confident, right? At the end of the last section, he says, you know, like, your God will protect you. And so that's what he says, but his actions are different. I'm also a basketball fan. One of the podcasts I listen to, the thing they talk about is actions over words. People in basketball circles will say lots of things, like GMs will say stuff about their players, or like, we're not going to trade this guy, and 2 days later, boom, they're gone, right? We're not going to sign this guy. It's like, hey, somehow you got rid of somebody and you signed somebody else. So talk is cheap, but not actions are what matter. So at the end of the last section, we see the king saying, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Like, not, he will deliver you, or maybe he'll deliver you, or whatever. He sounds pretty confident. But at the start of what we just read in verse 18, or whatever, it says that he's distraught. And he doesn't eat, he doesn't, you know, take music like he normally would. He doesn't have a Spotify playlist to play like kind of that soothing jazz to him so he can, whatever, calm down. He doesn't have any of that. He can't sleep. He's basically like, he's pacing, he's frantic all through the night. And so his actions are like, Daniel's dead. Like, this guy, like, you know, he's going to be dead. So in the morning, he goes off, and he runs off, And he calls into the pit, calls into the den, like, Daniel, are you safe? And he gets a reply. So the king's like ecstatic at this, right? That he is saved. Yeah, Daniel says that he was like blameless before God. He was even blameless before the king, that, you know, the Lord had saved him by sending an angel. But toward the end of the chapter, we see that the lions don't go unfed, that the people that had accused David were instead thrown into the pit. As I was looking at stuff about this, one of the, I forget who it was, but one of the commentators or whatever on it, had a great line, what I thought was a great line. And it said that Daniel wouldn't have been a good meal because he was all backbone. And so, you know, and I'm like, that's fantastic. You know, the lions got a much better meal in those other people than in Daniel, who had too much backbone or wouldn't have been satisfying. And so, you know, the plan didn't work out as planned for those people at all. They ended up losing their life instead of Daniel. So that's kind of the tour of this. And I just want to focus back in on kind of that idea of integrity for the last few minutes here. And we can see through this story about Daniel having integrity in three different parts of his life. We'll see in his personal life that he had integrity, in his professional life he had integrity, and in his prayer life he had integrity. So in going back again into early in the chapter, in verse 4, as his people, or his detractors, were trying to set him up, we read about Daniel, that they could find no fault in him. And that's when they were looking, like, really, really hard. Right? With some people, it might be pretty simple to find fault with them, or, you know, things that they're not good at, or, you know, ways they're being dishonest, or any of that sort of stuff. But if we read of Daniel, they could find no fault in him. And so, the integrity that he had in his personal life was, like, right to his core. It wasn't for show. It wasn't something that he kind of put on sometimes. It was just pervasive through his life. And what a great testimony that was. If you go back in the story of Daniel, we know that that's where we see that that's, you know, been his calling card for a while. At this point in Daniel chapter 6, it doesn't talk about how old he is, but if you look at the different kings that he served and kind of how long they were alive and in charge and all that sort of stuff, at this point in Daniel's life, he's probably about 80 years old. But back in Daniel 1, when he is taken, he is numbered among some of the younger people, so he would have been like probably a teenager or so at that point. And if you're familiar with the story of Daniel, there's him and some of his friends that get taken into the king's house, and they're going to be taught, you know, things of the Babylonian culture and all that sort of stuff. And they were supposed to eat, you know, the king's food and all that sort of stuff. And in verse 8, it says, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested the chief eunuchs that he might not defile himself." And so, from the very beginning, you know, as a teenager, being kind of taken off into a foreign land, and, you know, he wasn't in a cozy setting with a bunch of his friends. He had some of his friends there, but, you know, they were trying to indoctrinate him with something different. In that kind of setting, we see Daniel standing up and saying, you know what, my God wouldn't want me to do that. And so as a young man, we see Daniel not doing something that he thought was wrong. Here is like an older man, we see he still kept that, right? He didn't lose that over the course of his life. It wasn't beat out of him, or, you know, it wasn't subverted over the course of being part of a Babylonian culture and a Mede culture or any of that sort of stuff. He was able to live in the culture and keep personal integrity intact. So that's a really great example for Daniel to have. And so, kind of a takeaway for us is to have that kind of personal integrity in our life, to always do what is right, not just what is easy. It would have been really easy for Daniel to just be like, okay, I guess this is how my life's going now. I'm here. I want to succeed in kind of a Babylonian culture, so I need to be more like them. He didn't. He was like, no, I'm keeping my identity of who I am and the God that I serve. I'm going to do that. And even with that, he was able to rise up within the culture and to be, you know, rise to the place of being the king's right-hand person. So he had integrity in his personal life. We see in his professional life as well that Daniel distinguished himself above the others. And earlier in the chapter again, it says, because an excellent spirit was within him. And to the point, again, that Daniel was going to be promoted for his work and his integrity to the second command in the country. And we saw that, again, when people were looking for things to drag him down, that they could find no charge concerning the kingdom because he was faithful. So again, that idea that in his work, Daniel did all that he could. Like, you can have personal integrity and still be a bad employee, right? But we don't see that in Daniel at all. He had personal integrity and was a great employee, to the point that he was going to be second in command. And again, Daniel was doing this in hostile territory, not surrounded by his friends, and that he had demonstrated this kind of integrity to multiple kings. Darius is the third king that Daniel is serving in his life. So he didn't play favorites or, you know, work hard for one and not for another. He just constantly was doing what was required of him. And again, we see that starting at a young age. Back in Daniel chapter 1, when they refused to eat the king's food and all that sort of stuff, they had this period of eating on their own and, you know, studying on their own, doing all that sort of stuff. And when they get tested at the end of that period, it's about 30 days, it says of Daniel and his friends that they were found to be 10 times better than the others. So they didn't just take that time and slough off and just kind of, you know, sustain and just do nothing. They're found to be better than the others. We also see in Daniel chapter 2, towards the end of it, that Daniel's able to interpret a dream for the king. And he does it, even though, again, a hostile king that is asking for an interpretation of his dream. And he gets promoted out of that. So he's doing his job to the best of his ability, regardless of his situation. Again, I have no clue what you do, what situation you're in, but I would encourage you, based on what you see here in Scripture, to work as best you can. Over in Colossians chapter 3, Paul encourages the believers there to work as hard as they can. And he says, and whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive your reward of inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. And so, part of, you know, not everybody's a great evangelist and it's comfortable talking to people or sharing the gospel and that sort of thing. You can be, you know, a beacon for Christ just by being a good worker and doing what you're supposed to. And so that's something that we should encourage ourselves with over and over again. The third thing, so he had integrity in his personal life, his professional life. You see, in his third one. Is in his prayer life. Again, back in verse 10, it said, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. And so, from that, it's evident that praying was just a habit for Daniel. It was something, it says, again, from early days, that's something he had done. And so he's carrying through with that, and he didn't kind of lose gusto about doing it. It was just something unnatural that he had, something unnatural that he had turned into a natural state of being for him. You know, habits are hard to build, but once they are built, they're really hard to break. Does anybody here do Wordle? So I see a few hands. How many of you do like Wordle, like kind of occasionally? A couple hands. How many people do Wordle like every day? So there's more. Like, it's one of those things. If you're into it, you're into it, and you're probably going to do it all the time. Like I have a friend who does it, and like it's kind of they wake up to work like that's their thing, right? I'm not trying to say it's a good habit or a bad habit or that sort of stuff. But it's one of those things. Like if you do it, you are probably doing it every day because you know it's kind of built into what you do. Personally, I do it, so I don't have a set time to do it like some of my friends. But it's one of those things. Like if you get into it, you're probably really into it. And if you don't do it, it's like, oh man, I went all day. Like I need to get in before midnight, or I'm going to lose my streak, right? So it's a dumb example, but I think it gets across the point of building those habits. Once they're made, they are hard to break. Daniel had gotten to that point with his prayer life. That praying three times a day was just something he did. He didn't have to think about it too much or whatever. It was just something that he did because he had built that habit. And so he was making sure that he was going to do that again. It says this was his custom since early days. It's evident that he had a method for it. He had a practice that he would follow. It says that he knelt down facing Jerusalem, so and he had opened his windows so that he could see there. So there's lots of different methods of prayer and all that sort of stuff. I don't think this is prescriptive, saying if you're going to pray, you have to be down on your knees facing towards Jerusalem at an open window or any of that sort of stuff. But it's evident that worked for Daniel. That was something that he was doing, and that was what he was comfortable with. So again, if you're trying to form a habit of prayer, it would be good to find a place and a time and a method that works for you. And I would encourage you to do that. You know, some people have prayer lists or a journal or a calendar or that sort of stuff that works for them. So, you may want to find out a method that works for you. But I would encourage you to do that. And like I said, Daniel wasn't ashamed of it. It says that even when he knew what was going on, it would have been easy for Daniel to be like, okay, technically I can like not break the law if I don't pray, right? He could have done nothing and kept within the law, but he wasn't willing to break up with the Lord, kind of, or break fellowship with the Lord for a month. He did what he always did, and he opened the window because that was his habit. And it allowed people to see what he was doing. And he wasn't trying to do it to draw attention to himself, but it was what his habit was. So Daniel could have not prayed for a month and technically been okay. He could have prayed, have kept his windows closed, and maybe they wouldn't have been able to find him doing it, that sort of stuff. But he didn't do that. Instead, he just did what his practice was in the days of his youth. And so I would encourage you to, if you don't already have a habit of prayer or a method or timing or that sort of stuff, figure out what works for you and go forward with it. So just to close things off, I would suggest as Christians, we should be trying to live a life of integrity. And we've looked at a few different examples of that. It means doing what you should when nobody's looking, but also when they are. And it might be hard and it might be awkward. If you are in a non-Christian setting, it's easy to pray like for a meal or something like that when, you're at a church gathering and all that sort of stuff. It's a whole lot harder to do it. And I have to do it when I'm out, with my coworkers or whatever, if we go for a lunch or dinner or whatever. I'm usually the only person praying at my table or whatever. It's kind of awkward. Like, honestly, it is. But I'm just like, I'm going to take a few seconds to give thanks to the Lord for this meal that's been provided for me. If that means that the conversation around me happens and I'm not a part of it or whatever, or, people know it about me, so they'll, maybe not talk to me once the food shows up or whatever, just for a little bit. But that's just a really basic, simple thing to do. But it's just, one example or whatever that I think is helpful. And I've been able to have, people have asked me questions about what I believe just because of like that one little practice. When I'm at meals or whatever, so ask me what I believe or that sort of stuff, and so it's opened doors for me to share the gospel, in a quiet setting or what have you. But it's just one practice that can lead to that sort of thing. So like having integrity, you know, doing what you should when eyes are on you, and also when they're off. And so we've talked about integrity in your personal life, or in our personal lives, our professional lives, and in our prayer lives. And if you're struggling with your prayer life, you follow Daniel's example here. My intention this afternoon is to talk specifically about prayer and some examples of that, or I guess one example of it from the New Testament, and kind of break down how we can pray. And so if you're struggling with that, I'd encourage you to stick around for the afternoon meeting as well after our meal. And I'll just close off in prayer. Do you want me to give thanks for the meal? Yes? Okay. I will do that. Our Father in heaven, we're grateful for this example we've seen in the life of Daniel. This man of integrity who just wanted to serve you, and whatever that meant for him, he was willing to endure. He knew that the reward from you was greater than the reward from men, or even the punishment of men. And he was willing to go through with whatever was required to serve you. Lord, what a great example that is for us. We are thankful for this time of studying your word. We look forward to the meal that's ahead of us. We're grateful for those who have provided something for it. We pray for our time of fellowship and look forward to gathering back here in the afternoon to look at the life of prayer that we see in the Gospel of Matthew. We just pray for this now in Jesus' name. Amen.